If you want to do something, make it easy. If you don't want to do something, make it hard.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Paul Dolan, professor of behavioral science at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's an expert on human behavior and happiness. Paul is also the author of the best-selling book, Happiness by Design.
Stress happens to everyone. It's one of those facts of life. I'm sure you can think of a time recently when you were very stressed. We're working on helping people to better manage their stress. If you're signed up for our email list already, you know that we recently sent something to you about stress in your life, and we're going to be continuing on this topic, and we've got a new resource that's coming out soon called Eliminating Stress, Two Smart Strategies to Keep You Calm and Confident. If you're already on our email list, no need to do anything. The document will come your way this week. If you are not on our email list, go to oneyoufeed.net and sign up in the right-hand column, and you will get the next document about managing stress. And the main focus will be dealing with our thoughts and responsibilities. So if you're not on our email list, oneyoufeed.net to get signed up for these free resources.
And here's the interview with Paul Dolan.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Eric. It's nice to be on your show.
I'm excited to have you on. Your book is called Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think, which is a big part of the way I view the world. So this should be an interesting conversation.
Excellent.
Let's start like we always do with the parable. There's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson. He says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks about it for a second and he looks up at his grandfather and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
Well, why don't you start with an easy one? So it's interesting. So for me, behavioral science teaches us that so much of what we do is driven by context and environment and situation, and a lot less by cognition or, you know, by thinking and by the person that we think we are. So for me, I start thinking about that parable in terms of it's not really two selves. There's just context that activate those different selves, right? So we can design environments, organize our life and our day and our society in ways that make it easier for us to be kind, or we can do it in ways that make it easier for us to be greedy. So it would be more about which of those selves are activated in which environments and less about the selves themselves.
I love that answer. It's a great answer, and it ties in very much to a lot of the themes in your book. Let's start kind of at the beginning, because you make a distinction early on that, you know, there's traditionally been two views of the good life, right? One that we would consider perhaps more hedonic, right? A life of pleasure, contentment, positive feelings. And another, I think the phrase is more eudaimonic, right? Which is a life that is more well-lived and meaningful. And your point is really, we need a balance of both.
That is absolutely right. Although it's a little subtler than that. So in terms of how we measure happiness, and he always done the former, that hedonic, you know, pleasure and pain, by asking people questions about their pleasure and pain in the moments, in the experiences of their lives. Yet the eudaimonic is nearly always asked as whether your life has meaning, whether your life has purpose, whether when you reflect upon the narrative of yourself, you feel like it's been worthwhile. And so what I argue is that actually there's no reason in principle and in practice why we shouldn't be placing purpose on the same experiential footing as we place pleasure.
Yep.
Happy life is one that contains a balance between those twin sets of feelings. And the balance, I think this is really important, that's right for the individual. I try not to be too prescriptive in the book. I think a lot of happiness books, you know, generally try to tell people that there's a, you know, one size fits all way to live. And I just want people to work out for themselves what that balance is.
Exactly. So you say that a large part of how you feel is determined by what you do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, there's the production process of happiness. So I'm trained as an economist, although I've kind of morphed more into a psychologist over the last decade or so. And so I can't help but kind of, at some points, revert back to my econ training. And if you're a company producing widgets, right, you don't just obviously have widgets. They have to be produced by some process. And that production process is a process that converts the inputs, land, labor, capital, into widgets. And so you make more widgets when you have more of two things. One, you have more inputs, or you have a more efficient production process. So analogously in happiness, I talk about happiness being, people have always just really spoken about the inputs, income, relationships, unemployment, sex, all these things as if they are directly related to the output of happiness. But there's a production process in the middle that converts those inputs into happiness. And that production process is attention. So whether and how and in what ways, to what extent, money, marriage, employment and sex show up in your happiness depends on how much attention you pay them, right? So if you take income, for example, you know, it's true that money would make people very, very happy if they spent all their time thinking about how much money they had when they got rich. But they stop paying attention to money and pay attention to all the other things in life that largely have nothing to do with how rich they are. So it, in the sense of happiness being in what you do, it's in what you pay attention to. And a lot of our time, not all of it, of course, and we can talk about more about that if you wish, but a lot of our time is paying attention to, you know, the conversation that I'm having with you now, or paying attention to, you know, your commute to and from work, or the time that you spend with your family and friends, or the listening to music, or you know, all the things that draw your attentional resources towards them in ways that convert the inputs into happiness and, in a lot of cases, misery.
And so another way of saying this, I think, would be to say it's not just what's happening to us, right? It's the attention we pay to them and the perspective we take to those things that are happening. And you talk an awful lot about attention. And furthermore, you talk a lot about how we spend a lot of time thinking about what we think would make us happy. We think it's more money. We think it's this thing or that thing. And we pay precious little time to what actually does make us happy, and that we would be better served to pay attention to what actually causes our happiness in life, and then pay more attention to those type of things instead of diverting our attention to things that we believe may someday, somewhere provide happiness.
That's absolutely right, Eric. So if you think about, I mean, so the things that you pay attention to in a decision will often not be the things that matter in the experience of one of those choices. So if I'm thinking about, you know, choosing between two jobs, right? The most obvious dimension on which I will compare them is salary. It's actually not only the most obvious thing for me, it's the most obvious thing for other people, right? They expect me to compare the jobs on the basis of salary, right? They expect me to take the high paying job. And actually, if I don't, I've got a real, you know, kind of painful process of explaining to them why, you know, I think I might have better colleagues or a shorter commute in the lower paying job. So I'm kind of almost compelled in some way to take the job that pays more money because I pay attention to that attribute in the decision. And I think I'm going to pay attention to that attribute in the experience, right? So the job with a longer commute that pays more money, I'm going to think, that's okay, that longer commute is going to be compensated for by the fact that I'm richer. But actually, once you take the job and you experience your life day to day, moment to moment, that commute becomes very, very painful, very attention seeking. And the fact that you could have had another job that would have paid a little bit less with a shorter commute is kind of that income difference becomes irrelevant.
Right.
So in the experience of your life, you kind of you pay attention often to different things that matter to you when you make a decision. And moreover, we're not very good at predicting the things that will draw attention to themselves in those experiences. And so that's one of the fundamental reasons why we make quite a few mistakes and errors in our decisions that lead us to not be as happy as we might otherwise be.
Right, because we've got two things happening here. One is that, as you said, we're not very good at predicting what will make us happy. And we have to talk about the adaptation process in order to fully understand that. Do you want to explain that then?
Yeah. So when something new happens, something novel, surprising, interesting, you know, like a pay rise or a new date or a new house or a new car, or, you know, it pays, or actually bad things as well, right? So some adverse health effects, for example, we pay attention to them because they're novel and attention seeking. But something that initially starts off novel and attention seeking soon becomes many things, not all things, many things become kind of old and established, right? So when we can take an adverse event, when you experience an extreme health loss, maybe you become a paraplegic. Now that is very attention seeking, obviously, when it first happens. It's still attention seeking for the rest of your life, but it's not as attention seeking after a month, a year, and 10 years as it was after the first week. You essentially become a part-time paraplegic, right? So where your attention is only drawn to your paraplegia when your attention is drawn to it, when you're trying to gap a curb or when, you know, there's a kind of environment that makes you draw attention to it. The rest of the time, kind of get on with life and live it by and large in very similar ways to people without paraplegia. And we're not very good at forecasting that, right? We imagine that, oh, it'll just be awful for now and forever. We equally imagine that winning the lottery will be pleasurable for now and forever.
Yep. Right? Yep.
But the now doesn't last forever. The now quickly dissipates because we stop paying attention to many of the good things and bad things that life throws at us. And that's actually highly adaptive for us as human beings to get used to stuff, you know, because otherwise we might be living in quite considerable turmoil if we didn't.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. This can be really challenging to figure out. And when we try to deal with them on our own, when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I recently had a few things I needed to talk about, and I signed up for BetterHelp again. And I choose it because it's convenient, it's flexible, and it works well with my schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/feed today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/feed.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
And here's the rest of the interview with Paul Dolan.
The positive side of it, right, is the psychological immune system, right? That we get used to things. And you put a model in there that I had never really heard of before. I mean, I'm certainly familiar with adaptation, but you talked about a model of adaptation called the area model, which stands for, you know, attention. You know, something grabs your attention, you react to it. E, you explain the event. And once you can explain it, then you adapt to it. And I thought that was a really good way to look at it.
I properly referenced that. That's to Dan Gilbert, who wrote Stumbling on Happiness, and Timothy Wilson, who's at University of Virginia. So that's their model. Mm-hmm. But obviously, for me, what's key about that is the A bit, is the attention that something, you know, draws itself. And as you rightly say, that once we can make sense of why something has happened, we can kind of get used to it, right? So a very good example is when we split up with a partner, especially if we get dumped, right? If we got dumped, you know, that is pretty horrible. There's no doubt that those first few hours, days, and sometimes weeks are pretty awful. But very rarely months and years, right? Unless there's some kind of other maybe mental health, you know, issues going on. Mm-hmm. Most people get over people, and moreover, find someone better next, right?
Yeah.
So you don't get very many people who say, my current girlfriend or wife or husband isn't as good as the one I had before, right? Because it doesn't actually matter whether they are or not. Our psychological immune system tells us that they're better because it's our way of making sense and coping with the world.
Right. What was interesting to me about that is also explains why not knowing the answer or uncertainty in situations can be so difficult, and why once we have certainty, you know, we can explain the event in that model, then we can adapt to it. But while it's all kind of up in the air, it retains its novelty because we can't answer the question.
Exactly. It's almost, you know, that, it is actually often better to have tried something and it gone wrong than not to have tried it at all, because they're not trying it at all can sort of nag on you, you know, can sort of nag in your mind about what might have happened had you done it. And so that unresolved uncertainty is very attention seeking, whereas the resolution makes it easier to cope with. And that's why we see in most happiness literature that separation, when you break up, is very attention seeking and misery making. You only start getting happier again when you get divorced because it's final, it's over, and yep, I can move on.
Yep. I can attest to that. You say the key to being happier is to pay more attention to what makes you happy and less attention to what does not. That's pretty straightforward, but
I know. That's why I was laughing when you said it. It was like, what are we having? Some sort of statement of the bleeding obvious, you know, but what's funny is actually, I think I think a lot of the insights that I drawn in the book are actually really obvious. What the really interesting question is why they're so overlooked.
Right.
Right. It's not actually that, then, you know, if people say to me, when I say to them what things, you know, they should do to be happier, I say, you know, listen to more music, go outdoors, spend time with more people you like being with, help other people. And they say, well, that's obvious. I say, well, how much of it are you actually doing then? Right. If it's so bloody obvious, why aren't you doing more of it? And so the answer to that question, which is a more interesting one, is that we often make it very hard for ourselves to do things that would make us happy and pay attention to those things. We make it easy for us to do things that we pay attention to that don't make us feel so good.
Right, right. And to take that, you know, the next direction is to, you know, we're talking about changing what you do. And at the same time, you say, if you can't change what you do, then change what you pay attention to in the experience. So that one could use a little bit more unpacking than the last statement, for sure.
Yeah. Can I just say, the UK and the US subtitle of the book are both Happiness by Design. The UK subtitle, and what was going to be the US subtitle, is Finding Pleasure and Purpose in Everyday Life. Got it. Just as we were about to go to print, my US editor said, you know what, those Americans, well, she didn't say that because she was in the US, us Americans, she said, you know, we need something more directive. We need to be told what to do.
We can't figure it out ourselves. Yeah. That's why exactly. I do this podcast. There you have it.
Exactly. exactly. So the US subtitle became "Change What You Do, Not How You Think." Right. So that was quite an interesting insight, I think, into the cultural differences. But it is in exactly that. If I take a step back to answer your question, is that if you read any of the self-help genre, they will nearly always, without exception, say, you know, change how you think, right? Change, you know, be positive, whatever. Well, kind of, yeah, I'd work that out. That's why I bought a self-help book. I want you to give me some insight into how to actually do that. And of course, you can't. And that's why the self-help industry is so lucrative, because the likelihood of buying a self-help book is much greater if you bought one in the last 12 months. So clearly, they're not working. They're working at selling books, but they're not working at changing people's lives. And it's because they don't give you, it comes back to the previous question, the really simple insight is, if you want to do something, make it easier. They don't give you the tools mm-hmm. that enable you to design your environment, to organize your day and your life in ways that make doing the things that would make you happier easier. That's actually the fundamental challenge. So most of the time we can actually change what we do, right? So even incredibly busy people like me, I mean, I think I'm like the busiest person, you know, ever. You know, I've got a busy job. I'm a head of a department now at the LSE. You know, I do all these great academic things. I've got a family, but I still manage to go to the gym 5 times a week without exception. And people say to me, I don't have time to do that. So, well, it's not you don't have time. You don't make time. So I've organized my diary in a way that 5 gym sessions a week for 45 minutes to an hour, I just always do them. And I've made it easy for myself by having a gym that's nearby, by having a training partner that I go to the gym with, not all the time, but much of the time. And we just have an automated habitual system that makes it easy for me to do that.
Yeah, I've said this on the show several times, but I think for me, the I don't have time to exercise excuse went out the window when I realized that, you know, then President Obama exercised, you know, nearly every day. And I was like, there is no way on earth I can claim to be busier or have more important things going on than he does. Right. So like that excuse is gone. You know, it's a matter of prioritization.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So let's talk about designing our environment, because that's a big piece of what you talk about throughout the book, which is, you know, you're more likely to do something if it's easy to do. So, and I think we all underestimate, I know people that I work with a lot in coaching underestimate this. We all think it's all about willpower and how dedicated we are. And so much of it has to do with design and with our environment and crafting it in a certain way. So let's talk a little bit more about that. What are some of the things we can do, or what are some of the maybe ways to think about structure in our environment so that we can, A, make the changes we want to make to how we behave and also for happiness?
It's much less about willpower, more about design power. Because, you know, actually willpower is hard work, isn't it? Exhibiting willpower all the time.
Yep.
Force you to do something or stop yourself doing it. So what you want to do is you want to try to create habit loops. And so we see from some of the health behavior change literature that takes about 2 months to change a habit, right? So you need to be doing the same thing repetitively for it to be embedded and coded. So often what's interesting is a lot of times when people try to change their behaviors in whatever domain, they don't leave it long enough, you know, before they stop or start again, right? So New Year's resolutions, I mean, I don't know how many of those last to the end of February, probably none.
Very few. Right? Yep, very few.
So you've got to try and – so the way that you make that habitual process that then makes life easier for you subsequently more likely to kind of embed itself is by making it more likely, of course, is an obvious thing to say, that those behaviors will be carried out on the, you know, daily basis or whatever that you intend to do them. And that requires you to have a very clear implementation plan for your intentions. It's called implementation intentions in the academic literature. So it's the way in which you make the bigger plan more manageable and discrete, right? So it was actually used by Barack Obama. You mentioned him earlier in a different context to get the vote out by asking people. You don't ask people, are you going to vote in the general election? Right. There's actually a lot of behaviors embedded in voting. Right. Mm-hmm. You've got to, first of all, leave the house. You've got to find the polling station. You've got to know. Right. So the questions would be, you know, when are you going to vote? When in the day? How are you going to get there? Are you going to go with someone? Or are you going to go on your own? Right. So you've got a series of implementable plans that make intentions more likely to happen. So with any behavior that you want to change in your daily life, you need to have those plans in place. And those plans are more effective when drawing on the lessons from the behavioral sciences, which tell us some things that are really quite obvious, like we care about what other people around us are doing, right? We're social animals and we take our cues from other people. You're more likely to do something if lots of other people around you are doing it. You're more likely to do something if you make a commitment or a public promise to do it. You're more likely to do something if you have cues in your environment that make it more likely. So if you put even just those three things together, you might, if you want to go to the gym or exercise more, leave your trainers by the bed when you get up. You might have a gym buddy that you pre-commit to meeting at the gym at the same time every day or week in order to train with them. And you might join a running group or something that makes that behavior more likely. So all of these things make the implementation of that intention more likely to come about.
You use four terms in relation to this a little bit. You talk about priming, defaults, commitments, and norms. Let's walk through each of those real quick.
Okay. So I actually just very, very rapidly went through three of them in that example. So the priming is a cue in your environment that makes a behavior more likely. So the trainers by the bed, is just an example. You kind of fall over them, right? So you can't sort of help but see them. Or you might have a picture of you in the gym on your screensaver.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of the things I did in a different my editor in the UK, I've got in the example in the book, I say, if you want to spend less online shopping, whatever, change your banking password to don't spend so much money. and she actually did that. She said some version of it. Change the passwords to don't spend so much money, and she reckoned it worked. I mean, even just knowing we can actually fool ourselves, even though we know we're trying to fool ourselves, right? So that's how powerful some of these effects can be. Typing in "don't spend so much money" just at the margin stops you spending so much money, right? Yeah. So that's cue in your environment. So then defaults and commitments are actually quite similar. I mean, I just maybe pay attention in the interest of time to the commitments thing, is that you're just much more likely to do something when you make a public promise to do it. So if you said on air something that you're going to do over the next, and make it a short period and discrete behaviors, that you're going to go to the gym every day for the next week or something, if you say that publicly on air, you know, you're just a little bit more likely to do it because you don't want to not do something that you've promised to.
Yep. Yep.
And then the norms are, as I say, this is really such a pervasive effect. We really do take our cues for action from those around us. I mean, you know, you're walking down the street and everyone's looking up. What do? Look up. Right. I mean, it's just, you just are cued to do what others do. So you want to create a network of people who engage in the behavior that you want to. Lots of very good data from very robust studies over many contexts and years showing that not just our friends affect what we do, but our friends' friends and our friends' friends' friends, right? So you're more likely to quit smoking if your friend quit smoking, if their friend quit smoking, and their friend's friend quit smoking. All of those have a direct effect on your likelihood of quitting smoking.
Yep. We're near the end of time here, but you've kind of tied all this up into a framework to look at. You call it deciding, designing, and doing. And I think we've talked through each of those pieces a little bit, but can you maybe give a quick overview of that framework and how to put it into use?
Yeah. So we talked a lot about design, right? I mean, which is the principles of organizing. And this is a really, I can't emphasize this enough, Eric. I know it's a really basic insight, but if you want to do something, make it easy.
Yeah.
That is really, if you don't want to do something, make it hard. Right? That is, if you do that, if you can do that, you're a long way towards achieving your goals. We did the design bit. The do bit is really where we started in a way of paying attention to things that make you feel good. It's remarkable that, music therapy has been shown to be hugely effective across a whole range of health conditions, mental health conditions, physical health conditions. Music literally lights up your entire brain. Everybody, I would say, without exception, is happier when they listen to music they enjoy. So just do it, right? Design ways of listening to more music into your life. The deciding bit, I think, is maybe one of the more interesting bits, because it's where sometimes we have this idea of the person that we think we'd like to be. The number of journalists, for example, that I've met who say they're going to write a novel, right? Don't they all say that, right? Well, most of them don't. So I don't know actually how many of them actually really want to, but they say that because they think that's what a journalist should do. And so the deciding bit is obviously the first of the three Ds. But it's actually, probably the most critical bit in a way, because you need to be absolutely clear that this story that you tell yourself about the person that you want to be instead is actually going to play itself out in you feeling better and happier. So I'll just make a plug for the second book, which will be coming next year, which is called The Narrative Trap, which is actually going to be about the stories that people live in that often get in the way of them leading happier lives. We tell ourselves that we should be richer and more successful and married and all these things, when actually for some people those things are good, but the chasing of them is often quite harmful for many people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that gets to, you mentioned it briefly, and it was that this idea of the experiencing self, which is the part of us that can experience and enjoy happiness, versus the evaluating self, or another word for the evaluating self, right, is kind of the narrative self. It's that.
Exactly.
It's the stories we're telling ourselves all the time. And your basic piece here is pay attention to what actually makes you happy. Track your time. Watch what you're doing. Did I enjoy that? Did I not enjoy that? And move away from our beliefs about what will make us happy into our actual experience of what does.
You've read the book, Eric.
The whole darn thing. The whole thing.
You're better at explaining it than I am.
All right, Paul. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I know we're kind of up against our time frame here. So I appreciate the time, and let me know when the next book comes out and we'll talk again.
We will do. Listen, thank you so much. One of the things I talk about in the book is how, the scarcest resource that we have is our time. And, we're now half an hour closer to death than we were before we started. But I think this has been a very pleasurable and purposeful use of that half an hour. So thank you very much.
Me too. All right. Take care, Paul.
Cheers. Bye.
See you. Bye.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a donation to the One You Feed podcast. Head over to oneyoufeed.net/support. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.